I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Hey, why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, a weekly podcast illuminating issues in agricultural and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are addressed here using a science-based approach with the goal of driving discovery to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Kevin Folta.
Yeah, nothing like the voices of a Norman Borlaug and a Carl Sagan to whip a nerd into a frenzy before a new podcast. Yeah, hi, I'm Kevin Folta. This is the Talking Biotech podcast and episode one. And we're going to give this thing a shot to see if we could disseminate more information to a wider broadcast of people. See if we can get more people involved and thinking about the real beauty of some of our newest technologies and ways that they can serve the farmer, the consumer, the environment, and the needy. When we think about Borlaug and Carl Sagan, many others, all of those who've been before us, we realize that we do stand on the shoulders of giants, and that we today are in biotechnology and in science communication because many came before us and did the hard and arduous work, whether that was in the laboratory, in the field, or in front of the audience. And it's because of their efforts that we have the opportunities that we have today. So really the best way to think about this today is how do we begin to think about, and so what this whole podcast will be about over the next few weeks is how do we celebrate what are the real advantages of modern biotechnology? What are the wonderful things that have come from it? What are the risks? What are the benefits? What are the things we really need to be careful of? And what are the advantages we fail to take advantage of? And I think this is a really exciting topic because we've spent so many years now, about 20 years, those of us who've been studying biotech and really working in communication, defending perfectly good technology. And the problem with that is that it's exhausting. You kind of wear out when talking about the same points again and again, and you have to work from evidence as scientists, whereas people in the anti-biotech camps or the people who don't appreciate this technology can work from less than credible evidence bases. And so we think a podcast to really illuminate the wonderful things that we can do with science is a very good thing. So as I mentioned before, my name is Kevin Folta. I'm an active researcher. I'm a professor at a major university. I teach and find myself in front of public audiences frequently, sometimes as much as several times a week, talking about biotech or talking about farming. And for the last 30 years, I've worked in molecular biology research and have always been looking at the technologies therein as really cool ways that we can see science helping others. And during this podcast, we'll talk about those technologies and how we can apply them, and some really amazing stuff coming up about the ways that we're helping animal welfare, the way we're increasing plant output, the way we're feeding the needy, the opportunities to really help people. But that's only half the story, and that's the technology. The other side is really the teaching side, the communication side. And how do we communicate these ideas to audiences that don't necessarily understand biotechnology, or even those that are really against the technology because they've been so well misinformed by TV doctors and documentarians and booksellers and food babes, you name it. So how do we do that? How do we fix that problem? And so we'll talk about that over the next couple weeks. And I think the first few weeks here, first few episodes, you'll find a combination of science communicators as well as scientists and some scientists who also are science communicators. So, as we move forward, if you think of somebody you would like to hear on the podcast, be sure to send me a note. We're at talkingbiotech@gmail.com or on Twitter at talkingbiotech. The other thing that you can do, the other opportunity that will be unique to this, well, not unique to this podcast, but done by this podcast, will be for you to Twitter in or email in your questions. And at Talking Biotech, I'll be happy to answer them live on this podcast. The other thing I would really be excited about is if we could have people who aren't just, I don't want to preach to the choir. I would love to be able to interrogate some of the folks who have less than credible scientific opinions and really do welcome in a very fair and open way those that stand against biotechnology and those who fight biotechnology. Convince me I'm wrong. You know, keep an open mind, and I'd be excited to talk to those people. And it's about looking at evidence and weighing all the evidence and making good decisions. Because changing one's mind really is a good thing. Now, I know that in political circles, it's considered this weakness, this lack of a spine, flip-flopping. In science, though, a change of mind and changing your opinion or your mindset based upon evidence is actually the norm. It's actually rather a strong thing to do, that when data change your mind, to admit that and to accept a new point of view is a very good thing in how science moves forward. We can all think of examples through history where substantial new data was met with opposition, only to find out that science always wins. So for scientists, the idea of examining data and changing our minds is actually pretty easy. We're scientists because we don't know. We really would like to know. And we design experiments that really test the edge to figure out, are we self-deluded? Are we fooling ourselves? Are we really testing everything we can to get to our conclusions? We really leave the certainty and unwavering conviction to priests, politicians, and activists. As scientists, it's part of our job to identify when we've made a mistake. So my real job is to take the whole of the scientific literature or any given discipline and find a new edge. And this is where my research works. I'm still an active researcher. I have a wonderful lab of 10 of the most talented researchers you can ever find. And we challenge what we think. A lot of times we're wrong. Is that a bad thing? Yeah, not so much. See, because finding out you're wrong is really just as good as finding out that you're correct. In fact, it's even better. Most of the time, it means that you didn't think through the problem hard enough or maybe undersold its complexity, and that the story is really much more interesting than you first anticipated. As a scientist, I never want to be wrong. My master's degree advisor said things stay published an awfully long time. So we examine every single claim. We look very carefully at data, and we draw conclusions based on those. And this is what we do in science. Changing your mind to accept new evidence and to reshape your thinking is actually a very good thing. This is why my first guest is Julie Kay. Julie is known for her blog, Sleuth for Health. Julie's blog was dedicated to anti-GMO information, especially as it would apply to labeling back in the Proposition 37 time, back in, say, November of 2012. And soon after, Julie changed her tune. We'll explore her journey with her today as the first interview here at Talking Biotech is Sleuth for Health, Julie Kay. We're here in actually the very first interview on Talking Biotech, and I'm really excited to welcome all the way from the non-sunshine state of Oregon, the Sleuth for Health blogger named Julie Kay. Julie, welcome to Talking Biotech.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And it's really nice that you are here. I had to have you in our flagship first effort here because you're somebody who I deeply respect in many ways, because you are really somebody who took on their beliefs with a rather open mind and examined evidence and made some decisions. And it's something that really changed 180 degrees, the direction of your blog. And rather than me tell the story, maybe you could tell me or tell us a little bit about your blog, say, prior to, early 2013, back around Proposition 37. What was the main goal of the blog, and what were your stories usually about?
I just had become concerned about food and food possibly being the source of some of the health problems that were showing up in, you know, our society. And the only reason I even thought it could be food is because I started reading, you know, way too much stuff on the internet, and not, I don't think that I was, first of all, I don't think I was prepared for all that I would find there. And second of all, I did not know how to sift the information and determine what was really correct or not. And the second piece to this is that I had just lost a brother to cancer. And he was so healthy, and I just couldn't figure out how this could have happened to him. And I think that played a part as well.
And I think that's really common. I think that whenever we either personally or a loved one undergoes some sort of a change in their health status, we do search for a meaning why. You know, we want to know what happened. Is it something I could control? Is it something that I did? Is it something I ate? Is it something I breathed?
Yeah.
I think that's such a natural response. And as you see this when you look at vaccines and autism, you know, and how even to this day, people hold fast to that idea. And so, so what were some of the topics that you would have blogged about back in 2012?
Well, you know, I was a typical, you know, responder to Google, and you know, you Google GMOs, and the first thing that comes up. First of all, to start this thing, I latched on to GMOs are bad. I latched on to that whole camp. I just latched on to that. And you know, to be honest, all the information that I found at the time was all anti-GMO. And it was very convincing to someone who was kind of new to this. And, you know, I'm not a scientist. I don't have a science background. So when someone writes studies show that, you know, blah, blah, blah happens when, and these kinds of things, there's no studies cited, you know, there's no data to back this up, but they just put studies show. And I didn't realize then at all that that was a red flag. That's not good enough, studies show. Because I now know that a true report such as that would cite the study that they are referring to, you know.
And that's really difficult. It's difficult for many people, and I totally understand how you could go down that road, because you know, the stuff looks really legit. And for me, it's taken me years of training to be able to sort that out. And so what were some of the things that really made you start to reevaluate your stance? What was it that made you suspicious that maybe what you were reading wasn't true, and that maybe you needed to rethink your position?
Well, the very first thing that made me, you know, that raised a red flag was my son, who had just graduated from high school, had taken a lot of advanced science in high school. And, you know, he's no fool, you know. And I had shown him that very infamous Seralini rat study, the tumorous rats thing that still has legs today, with the GMO-fed, you know, rats that had those grotesque tumors and whatnot. And I showed him that. And you know what he said? He said, "Where's the control group?"
Yeah.
You know, this is from out of the mouths of babes, right? And I just, that was really honestly the first red flag. Now, granted, I still went on with my anti-GMO stuff, but that registered with me because I knew my son, you know, he's no dummy. And I, you know, that was probably the first thing that alerted me that I may be wrong. And then the other things that started to alert me was two things. Number one, it seems like when people don't have facts on their side, no matter what the topic is, and I'll even throw religion into this basket, when someone wants you to believe the way that they do and they don't have facts on their side, they use emotion, right? They use fear or, you know, bleeding heart for some sick child or, you know, some sort of emotional hook. And that's how they get you. But when something is correct and true, you don't need to use emotion. Of course, I didn't know that at the time. This is something I realize now. But even though I didn't know that then, that was starting to bug me. Like, I didn't like the propaganda. I didn't like the sensationalism. I didn't want my heartstrings tugged on. That just didn't seem right to me. Even though I was still believing it all, it started to resonate as not good to me. And, you know, it was just a kind of a, it was coming across conspiracy theory-ish, you know, and I'm not that.
Well, that's interesting because you didn't necessarily embrace better information. You were actually turned off by the information you were being given, or at least the tone of the information that you were being given.
Starting to be turned off. I don't even know that I could have articulated it then, like, no, maybe this isn't right. I don't think I could have said that. But I mean, I was just, you know, my blog at the time, the subheading was Getting to the Truth About GMOs. And I really did want the truth. I wanted to get to the bottom of it. What I was later to find out was not what I expected to find out, you know, but that's what I wanted. I wanted the truth. I didn't want sensationalism. I didn't want propaganda. I didn't want my heartstrings tugged on. I didn't want to be frightened into my position, you know. I just wanted the facts.
I think that's really hard for people to understand sometimes, especially people who have very deeply held beliefs, that it's okay to challenge those beliefs sometimes. And it's okay to rethink our positions and make sure that we're not tricking ourselves. And and I'm not just being a brown nose here, but it's a very high compliment to say that you really were able to do that and able to evaluate your position and make a change based upon prevailing evidence. And so I know that we had a couple conversations back then and had a good time with that. And so we don't have to talk about, you know, our conversations. But what were some of the lines of evidence that really convinced you that you needed to reevaluate?
Well, before one really big, I do want to bring up one thing. Before I really started to look at the pro-science side, kind of the last straw for me was... and I've talked about this on my blog, but it was just so huge, was that corn report that came out that was so blatantly not corn, you know?
Yeah,
and it didn't even have any carbon in it or whatever, and it was just... And I'm, like I said, I'm no biologist, I'm no scientist, but I'm also not stupid, you know? And these people just were stupid that were trying to sell this thing as, you know, the GMO corn versus the non-GMO corn and all the stuff that the non-GMO corn had, that the GMO corn had been stripped of and robbed of. I mean, it was absolutely absurd.
Yeah, let me step back for just a moment. This was the famous stunning corn comparison that showed up on Moms Across America.
Yes.
And that Moms Across America, they published a basically a table that's used for soil testing. and the numbers were fudged. And the numbers reported to show GMO versus non-GMO corn, and the GMO corn, as Julie mentioned, had nothing in it, like no carbon, had nothing except for it had loads of formaldehyde and glyphosate, which are both carbon-based, and all kinds of data that when you look at that, it's not even biological. And the funny part is that when I brought that to their attention, you know, I was destroyed in their comments section. And even to this day, Zen Honeycutt and Kathleen over at Moms Across America will swear those data are legitimate. And there's a lot of great stories around that that we'll probe further as we go forward in talking biotech. But what else did you find that was really a turnoff to you, or maybe helped you to find your way through the science?
Well, that was a huge one. That one stands out as the one that really that was a tipping point for me, because I thought, okay, I do not want to be on the side of just ignorance and stupidity and refusing to see that this cannot possibly be corn. And I just was like, no. And that was just huge for me, honestly. So I think that maybe you could say it was more the stupidity of that than, you know, than the opposite side. It's like I knew that was not correct, right?
Yes.
So something else had to be. And the I don't know if I've ever talked about this before, but the other piece to that is this Howard, was it Vlieger, the farmer behind those samples?
Yes.
The Moms Across America did this phone conference with him. And I watched it. It was on video. And he was saying all of these things in the samples that he found, and they were just sitting there at their computer desks going, really? And I mean, it was laughable, honestly. It was, I was just going, oh my goodness. And, you know, it was just very, very pivotal, a very pivotal point in my evolution in this whole thing. So I cannot stress how much that affected me.
Wow.
So after I knew that was not the way I wanted to go, then I was much more open to the way that I did, you know, to science, because I thought, well, that's wrong. There's got to be something more correct than that. And like I said, all I ever wanted to know was the truth. You know, I wanted to get to the truth about GMO.
And so when you did switch and you started to blog favorably about biotechnology, which I remember in the beginning was very conservative, and it wasn't it wasn't like you know, said hail Monsanto, you know, got a new, you know, Roundup Ready tattoo or something. I mean, you know, you rolled it out kind of easy. But how did you see a shift in pushback, like from maybe people who regularly followed your blog, friends or relatives? How did that change?
Well, I definitely lost all of my original followers. I had a few that kind of hung with me for a while, and then they just, you know, they were out of there. But I found a bunch of new followers, and I just found a whole new world that you know, came to the blog. A lot of it was, you know, farmers, scientists, people like myself who were on the fence and kind of leaning more toward pro-science. A couple of people even started to let me know that I helped them, you know, change their minds, and that really made me feel good. It, you know, kind of happened gradually. And then I, you know, I started finding some of my favorite websites that I would go to for information. And back then, there weren't as many. I think it's gotten better now. You know, I think that the pro-science stuff has fought back, you know, and is getting more presence online to fight the nonsense out there. And I think there even needs to be more pro-science stuff that's easily accessible to people. And there need to be, you know, characters that are as compelling as a Zen Honeycutt, you know, who are as persuasive.
And just to clarify, she's a one of the folks from Moms Against America, as it would be, Moms Across America, who presented the corn data and also other data that they claim is true about glyphosate, and which are very curious, semi-unbelievable data. Mm-hmm. And this is where they come from, but they tell a compelling story that changes people's views, and it's good that science is finally pushing back. What is your best approach now to engaging people who maybe, let's say, don't hold favorable opinions towards biotechnology? How do you approach them, and what strategies do you use to help them realize, as you say, realize the truth?
Well, that's a tough one for me. To this day, I'm not nearly as confident in person being pro-science as I am on the blog. Because, you know, I live in a very, heavily anti-GMO populated area. And, I just found out, for example, my sister-in-law, I was not there when the conversation happened, and I don't know what I would have done if I would have been there, but I found out that my sister-in-law is very anti-GMO. And I'm already sitting here thinking, how am I going to handle this with her? Because I have held back. I might say a few things like, well, you know, the evidence is really in favor of it, but I try not to get into it with people yet. I guess partly because, you know, I'm not a scientist, and I don't feel like I have the knowledge base. Even though I kind of do, but I don't know. It's, you have to be super confident with facts to be able to really debate someone who's just flag waver for the anti-GMO. I mean, you know, I don't want to get eaten alive, so.
I think you do raise a very important point, is that when you're talking to people who don't use facts and evidence as a basis for argument, it's, and you really want to adhere to it, you want to make sure that you have it really nailed down. And this isn't just a one-faceted discussion. I mean, there are so many different parts of this discussion. And someone with a good Gish Gallop can really give you a difficult time in a public place or in a public forum, make it look like you don't know anything. And that's part of the reluctance of engaging.
It is. You know, one of the things that also that I didn't mention earlier that I do say to people when I get the chance is trust the experts. And that is the thing that has gotten lost in this whole debate, which shouldn't even be a debate, but it is a public debate anyway. And that is scientists, you know, people who live, eat, breathe this stuff. This is what they love. This is what they do. This is where their expertise is. They are not believed. And then some, you know, Joe Schmo, like a Jeffrey Smith, the Institute of Responsible Technology, I think it's called, is introduced as an expert in biotechnology, which is just absurd. He's not an expert. He's never even studied science at all.
I always refer to it as the broom closet for responsible technology.
Yeah, I mean, but people believe this, and they have this mistrust of the actual experts. And that was another huge shift for me, is, you know, trust the people who know what they're doing. These are the people who work with this stuff every day. Certainly they know what they're doing. This is what they do. I mean, it's just common sense. It's common sense. It's logical. I mean, it defies logic not to believe scientists on this matter, my opinion. But it defies logic not to believe the vast preponderance of scientists and what they have to say.
So what are some of the topics that you've had on your blog recently?
Oh, well, my latest blog post was about on the show The Doctors, which is kind of like a Dr. Oz kind of show. It's on daytime. They had this whole glyphosate scare was the topic on there. Because the World Health Organization, I can't remember the name of the subgroup that...
Yeah, IARC.
...released a report saying that, you know, it could be a carcinogen, which, what does that mean? It could be, I mean... Anyway, they were talking about that on there, and they had a toxicologist from Monsanto on the show. And I have to say, they gave her a nice chunk of time on the show to explain herself. And then, of course, they had Jeffrey Smith, and he did his thing. And, of course, the audience was very clearly anti-GMO, and most of the doctor panel was anti-GMO, or at least leaning that way. But one of the doctors on the show was actually quite rational and said, look, I've got a lot of farmers in my family, and they use glyphosate, and, you know, they have to do it to survive. It's a tool for them. And he says you always have to weigh the benefit versus the risk, and... You know, I thought he was quite rational in his comments. So I thought that the whole handling of the topic was way better than what we would have gotten on, say, Dr. Oz, my opinion. But anyway, I did a post about that, how I thought that it was at least, you know, not hysterically out of balance, and that it at least tried to present a... you know, an even-keeled discussion about it. And I'm not pro-glyphosate, but what my interest in that was more the hysteria. How fast could the hysteria spread? And would they be rational about it, you know? Would they handle the topic in a rational way? Because I just think that people need to realize that, you know, this hysteria stuff spreads really fast, and it's really easy to get caught up in it.
Well, especially when Smith, he came on that show, and I needed to do a blog on this topic. He misrepresented science one after another. He spoke of the report from Fiona Price, who's a reproductive toxicologist, who did a very nice report on glyphosate and showed that glyphosate was not causing trouble in cells and was not an endocrine disruptor. And Smith comes right on and says, it says right in her report that it's an endocrine disruptor, because he doesn't read reports. He doesn't know how to read the reports. He knows how to read titles of memes on the internet where people misrepresent science. And so it is kind of sad when they'll have him on and they won't even make my phone ring. And I understand all that stuff in great detail. I think the difference is that if they talk to me or they talk to you, we're not going to tell them something exciting and sensational that's going to raise ratings. We're going to tell people, hey, your food supply is the best in human history. Enjoy it. Let's try to get it to more people on our planet. And that doesn't put butts in the seats.
No, the sensationalism is entertainment. You know what? Honestly, a lot of this anti-GMO sentiment out there is, in kind of a base form, a way of entertaining people. It's kind of this cause they can get all wrapped up in, and they can march and do all these things, and it's like you feel like you're controlling something, and it's our food, and this is such a basic thing, and boy, wouldn't it be nice if...
Well, sure. No, it has all the right narrative. It's got heroes. Yeah. It's got villains. It's got, got nature versus chemicals versus, and you can spin this in a very appealing way that attracts lots of bandwagon jumpers.
Yes, exactly. And it's something basic like our food, you know.
Right. It's something it's easy to get a bunch of people, you know, a bunch of guys in bee suits to show up and dance on the corner. It's that's just the way it rolls. So, Julie, just to kind of wrap up then, so you really made a personal journey here, a little transition from one way of thinking to another, and it's my hope that, you know, I'm not preaching to a choir here, that people are listening who have an interest in the topic because they don't understand. And if to someone sitting on the fence, and say, you know, a mom like you or someone who's on the fence who doesn't know which way to go with this, what would you advise them in terms of how to think about this and how to challenge themselves?
Well, as a place to start, I would look at my blog, because this blog is an honest blog of a person who did take this journey. And I start out anti-GMO, and then I start reading about science, and there's some science stuff in there that is very digestible, as I'm explaining it. And I've got interviews with farmers on there. I've got a Q&A with you on there, and just countless other articles where I link to very, very good science reports, articles, other websites that are kind of my go-to websites. And the important thing is to make sure everything, I mean, if you're really on the fence and you want the facts, make sure that you seek out information that is science-based, that is accepted in the science community, not a couple of mavericks out here in left field, you know, bringing up some experiments that only they conducted and no one else did. Not that. Okay, but general consensus science types of information, because that's where the facts are. That's where the evidence is.
Well, even if all the scientists, you know that all the 100,000 scientists on the planet have all been paid off by Monsanto, and
right,
all the, right, and they, you know, they only allow scientists to publish things that they say because Monsanto controls the scientific literature, right?
That is correct, and it amazes me that they're able to pay their regular employees and their stockholders, because they're so busy paying scientists all over the world
to not do science, which is
science.
It's always amazing to me. Well, I really, you know, so let's go through where do people find you? If you give us the URL to your blog and also your information on Twitter, how do people get in touch with Sleuth for Health, and how do they find you?
Sleuth for Health, all one word, SLE, you know, Sleuth, and then the number four, and then health. You can find me on Twitter. And then sleuthforhealth.wordpress.com is my blog. And, you know, I'm just a regular gal, you know, who started in the anti-GMO camp and decided after I learned better that I had been wrong. I was just flat out wrong. And my blog tells the whole story.
Well, the fact that you can change your mind, Julie, says you are far from regular. Thank you so much for taking the time with me today. I really look forward to talking to you again pretty soon, and hopefully get out to Oregon again and we'll have another IPA, okay?
You bet.
All right, take care. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Well, that was Julie Kay in our first interview on Talking Biotech. We'll take a short break here and come back on the other side with your questions as we receive through the hashtag Talking Biotech.
What can you do to help spread the science through Talking Biotech? Our goal is to advance discovery to application through communication, ensuring the best technology is able to benefit the farmers, consumers, the environment, and the needy. The Talking Biotech podcast is 100% funded by the Kevin Folta Family Vacation Fund, and no contributions or advertisers will be solicited or accepted. What you can do is kindly take a few minutes and write a review on iTunes, tell a friend, or scratch talkingbiotechpodcast.com into a bathroom stall at Chipotle. If you have questions, please send them to talkingbiotech@gmail.com or post them on Twitter with the hashtag TalkingBiotech. A podcast dedicated to these issues is long overdue, and your simple assistance will allow us to reach a wider audience with the important information
about biotechnology. And this is really where, going into this part of the podcast, will be where I answer your questions as they come in through the Talking Biotech hashtag on Twitter or through Gmail at talkingbiotech@gmail.com. And I'll be happy to answer any questions, try to keep it short, and move from one to another kind of rapid fire. Longer format questions maybe incorporate into future podcasts as more feature items. So this is how this will normally work, and then we'll go to our interview about some aspect of crop domestication. So here we go.
So during the discussion,
we'd love to answer your questions. Just use the hashtag #TalkingBiotech.
From the internet and answer them, that this would be of interest. And so I decided that this would be at least part of any kind of podcast I'd do. So right now I'll be able to answer a few questions from the internet which have come from the hashtag #TalkingBiotech. So let's take one from at Killam Ducks. Bill asks, do you think GE deniers have thought of how they'll be remembered in history? I guess dollars now trumps history. Later. You know, Bill, I think that it's important, and I think it is really a big deal for us to focus on how we all feel about how history will be reflected and how our beliefs and how the what we stood for and what we stood up for changed the future. And once we're part of that future, we'll be able to look back and see how we did. And I'm afraid that a lot of the sentiment of scaring people away from food really does have a very negative implication in terms of how fast we'll be able to accept new technology here, but also how that technology really does reach the developing world. And activism that currently is going on to deny people of basic access to new technologies, I think will be reflected very poorly in the future. Science hippie Tyler, at Tyler to Douglas, says, Kevin, advice for average Joe on spreading awareness on the safety of GMOs. And I think it really boils down to two areas, Tyler, and that is, if you talk about the basic safety, their record is really good. I mean, there hasn't been any single case of reported problem with regard to these technologies with respect to human health. And I think the safety record is really outstanding. There's other good evidence that comes to us from Allison Van Enenim that discusses how many cattle, which most of this is animal food, how many cattle have been treated and have lived successfully without changing their physiological metrics. And this is very good evidence that suggests that these are safe foods. But for me, it goes back to the idea that there's no plausible mechanism that it would be harmful, at least any more harmful than breeding. I mean, everything carries risk. But at least with the GM foods, they're tested and those risks are assessed. And I think they make them the most well-tested foods on the planet. The next one comes from Morgan at 707 Morgan M. How can we apply pressure to get enriched foods to nations in desperate need? And Morgan, you know, my heart goes out to you on this one. This is exactly how I feel. Is how do we convince governments of technologies with people in need to more rapidly adopt technologies that they can benefit from? And I think the nice thing about this, and I think the changing face of this, is that we now see other governments, especially in the African continent, taking the lead, and that people there are saying, we're not going to wait for approvals or gates or whatever. I think you see them taking an interest in their own people and in pushing through new solutions. I'll know more about that as time rolls forward, and certainly we'll report on it here. The next one comes from, hey, Michael, a student that I know. I won't try to even pronounce his last name because you won't get it right. I know Michael Jakovich. Kevin Folt is finally doing a podcast, ask questions using, okay, so that wasn't a question, it was a statement. Thank you, Michael. Another one here. Asniv B says, autism, and is there a correlation with herbicides and pesticides since genetics in utero are involved? And I understand your concern on this because people have been scared witless with correlations. We've seen increased herbicide use, which really hasn't increased that much. It's increased, but the amount per acre has remained the same. So it is really kind of deceitful and deceptive for someone like Dr. Seneff to just relate a amount of total herbicide used in our country, and that includes residential and municipal uses, and relate that to a disease that a lot of people are suffering from, or a disorder. autism disorders have not been increasing in prevalence. We've been including more people on the spectrum as our sensitivity and diagnostics are better. And as we start to understand how we can help and diagnose people earlier to get them in the therapeutic regimens to assist them in living very productive lives. So the whole idea of correlation and confusing correlation and causation, that's a real problem. When you start saying that glyphosate use has increased and autism has increased, therefore they're related, it's really sad, because the problem is autism needs a cure, and we need to be identifying what the real causes are. And are there environmental triggers? Yes, some do say, but they haven't related that to herbicides. At least they haven't related that to glyphosate at all. So to make those claims in an effort to make a political or activist statement is really disingenuous. And when I see those claims, I immediately question the people who are doing it. The one thing that I would really like to see is I'd like to see MIT stand up and represent. I'd like them to say, here's our scientist who's making these claims on behalf of MIT, and we're going to stand behind them, and they won't do that. Let me do one more here. So do transplanted genes replace non-coding, or coding for that matter, DNA, just as they're added to the genome? And that comes from Bobby at SkeptiBeard. Bobby, so the question is, does a transgene as it enters the genome change the genome? And does it change genes that they're entering into? And that could happen, certainly. So you have to think of it like this. Think of it like the genome as an encyclopedia. Let's think of it just as a book. Let's just say a Bible, for just so everyone kind of knows what that is. And it's like dropping a sentence from or a word, a couple words from just cut that out of Bambi and drop it right into the middle of Mark's letter to the Ecclesians, or I don't know, is there an Ecclesian? It sounds like there might be. So it's just saying that you're dropping this down into a different context. And it's foreign. It doesn't necessarily fit there. But you have to remember that a genome, especially in some plants like corn, is mostly non-coding regions. And so this inserts very easily into those areas. You also have to keep in mind that nowadays sequencing is so cheap and so fast that the companies that do this, they'll do the genetic insertion and then sequence where that gene is inserted, and be able to ensure that it hasn't affected another gene or it hasn't likely landed in a place of consequence. So this is a way that companies ensure further the safety of these products. So I'll stop there with questions for today. And hopefully, if you ever have questions, please put them in through Twitter with the hashtag TalkingBiotech. And I'll be really excited to answer those for you. And anything that I don't know off the top of my head, I'll be happy to research before I do. So, hashtag Talking Biotech.
Now it's time for Amazing Crop History.
Yeah, Amazing Crop History. So this is an interesting part of the podcast, because it really is more of a interest and a hobby than it is an area of my expertise. Whereas, I'm guessing I'm hitting a middle-age crisis, and where most guys go buy a Corvette or get a girlfriend, I really was interested in researching the origins of our food crops. Yeah, I know. It's yep, that's some crisis. The good news is that I'm in a business where I'm surrounded by experts who actually study these things. And understand the way that humans have contributed to improving crops. And I think that a genetic improvement of crops is a really important concept in a podcast on biotechnology, because it reminds us that humans have been changing crops for a long time, that we've taken what nature gave us, which is really pretty thin, and through breeding and selection, or mostly through selection for many years, we weren't actively breeding, or if we were, we didn't know it. But through selection, we're refining what a crop really was, and changing what the basic genetic components of those plants were. And over the next few weeks, over the next few podcasts, I will begin to feature prominent experts in crop domestication. And they'll tell us a really cool story. Each one has a great story about where our food, and in some cases other products like cotton, where they come from. So that's it for the first installment of the Talking Biotech podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you can tell a friend and get more people involved. And I guarantee you that the first one will be the roughest one and the one with the least content, despite an excellent interview with Julie Kay. But coming up, lots of incredible stuff aligned over the next week. This first week, I had about, a couple days to really get this going, and had a lot of other considerations like the website to work on. So going forward, the foundation is in place, and all I have to do is add the layers. So excited to talk to you more on Talking Biotech. Please send your suggestions. I'd be excited to talk to others. And in the future, also, we'll have a number of guest hosts. So my name is Kevin Folta, and that's the first installment of Talking Biotech. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review of this podcast on iTunes and recommend it to a friend. More downloads help us reach a wider audience with science.